This is KMUW, Wichita Public Radio. Engage ICT Democracy on Tap is a community engagement event series of KMUW Wichita. The following event took place on June 13th at Roxy's Downtown in Wichita, Kansas.
That races are more competitive than you might think, and incumbents are not always safe. And so here we see in Kansas, we've had massive shifts in the legislature in 2010 and then 12 to the right, in 2014 and 15 to the left. And those things really mattered. And I think it's fair to say that pretty much no Kansas sitting legislature can feel safe in their seat right now. The conservatives have to worry about having upheld Brownback's veto and being hit with a moderate challenger and maybe even a Democrat in the fall. The folks, especially the moderate Republicans that voted for the budget, have to worry about conservatives hitting them with the fact of passing what can fairly be called the biggest tax increase in the history of the state. And also, we found that Democrats can win races that you wouldn't never necessarily think they could win. And also, just because an expert tells you something like I would have said about 3-4 years ago, that there's no way you could beat a conservative incumbent from the left in a Republican primary, that turns out that's entirely incorrect. And a couple of other things taken from actually the experience of Donald Trump and the Republican Party recently. One is, if you run for office, one thing you should keep in mind is if you don't win, especially in a multi-candidate field, you might be hurting the kind of candidate who is your second choice, assuming yourself is the first choice. And you can see that in the experience of people like Jeb Bush and John Kasich in the Republican primary, where they ran for office, it became clear they weren't going to win, and for Bush, he hung around for an extra week and threw all of his money at Marco Rubio, the one candidate he might be able to stomach of the rest. And John Kasich ran for months with no clear way to ever get enough delegates to win. And those decisions to run and then stay in were very important in Donald Trump winning the nomination in a very surprising way. And the last thing to say is, if you do ever get elected to whatever you run for, state legislature, county commission, school board, and you run on a campaign of thinking, well, something that's going on could be done better, or the people that are in office are not making good decisions because of their own base self-interest. And all those things might be true. But you might find out that actually the people in office are behaving like they're behaving and making the decisions they're making because of real serious kinds of forces that they don't have a lot of control over. And the president now has found that actually the way Washington works often works there for a reason, with entrenched bureaucracies, rules that don't change easily, and also the incentives of all the people that are there before you get there and that are probably going to be there after you leave, and you got to deal with the people who are in the room if you want to be in the room where the decisions get made. But also, if you don't run, then you're never going to be in the room. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next panelist this evening is Tabitha Lehman, who is with the Sedgwick County Elections Office. Tabitha, tell us about your area of expertise and why you're on the panel.
Okay. Well, I'm on the panel because you asked me to be on the panel, so that's why I'm here. I am the Sedgwick County Election Commissioner, so my area of expertise is how do you file for office? I wanted to speak some to how you get on the ballot to start with, and then what services our office can provide you. Obviously, we are not in the business of helping specific campaigns. We're not going to give you campaign advice. We regularly will have a person come in who's filing for office for the first time, and they'll say, okay, so what should I do? No, we are not going to tell you that. You get your own people for that. That is not our role. Our role is to conduct the election and not to have anything to do with your campaigns. So I can answer questions on how do you file. You know, a broad overview would be if you're filing for a state or federal office, you have to do so at the Secretary of State's office. You can come to our office and we can attest your signature, but those documents do have to go to the state. If you're doing county or anything below that, then you would file with our office. Many people don't know you can skip the filing fees and file by petition. We have a unique situation this year. This is the first year that our city and school elections are in the fall. And we had a handful of cities that actually changed their requirements for petitions to be one signature on a petition. So like they would get their spouse to sign it and they would walk in the door. And those are great petitions for us to process. We look it up and yep, you're good. If we can look it up very quickly. But each city can do their own regulations and rules as to how many petitions you have to have, how many signatures you have to have on the petition. So just know what office you want to file for before you come in so that we can get you helped out. And then we offer services where we can provide you with maps. You'd have to pay for these services, but we will provide you with maps of your district, whatever you want. Our GIS department's very good at creating maps unique for what you need. Or they've also created a really great online mapping tool where you can go on and put whatever layers you want on that map, and you can go down and look at a specific house and even look up who owns that house, what all the districts they're in, what districts they pay taxes on. We use that all the time, actually, because we'll have somebody call and they'll insist, I am in this school district and I demand to vote on this thing, and we'll look it up and we'll say, no, our records are correct. You're not paying taxes in that school district. You're paying taxes in this school district. We use that map all the time, but that's something that you should be aware of as a candidate. We also have records that you can purchase, where you can purchase a list of the registered voters in your district. That's a very useful tool that people use. We can also give you voter history so you can see who has voted in the past election, so you can target who you're campaigning to more, to people who are likely to vote. One of the things that we see from our perspective is what drives voter turnout, at least from our end, what it looks like is who's on that ballot and how much active campaigning is going on and how hotly contested that race is. And we saw that on April 11th here in Sedgwick County, particularly, that we had, you know, we didn't really have anything to base that election off of because we haven't had that type of an election since 1950 in the state of Kansas, but we saw higher turnout than we expected, which was great. That's what we want to see. We want to see higher turnout. We don't like these low turnout elections. I was actually, before I came over here, just looking at past statistics for city primaries, and I'm looking at 4, 6, and 9% voter turnout for city primary elections. And just so you know, if you live in Wichita City Council District 1, if you live in Park City District 3, Ward 3, or Hayesville Ward 4, you have a primary election on August 1st, and you need to go vote. So get your information about your candidates before you go there, because your election workers cannot answer any questions about who is on the ballot. And they are nonpartisan. The city school elections are nonpartisan, so you will not see a party affiliation next to any candidate's name on the ballot this fall. So I think that's kind of a quick overview of what I could offer and answer questions on. So,
thank you, Tabitha. Our next panelist this evening is Lamont Anderson. He is with the Brandon Johnson's campaign for city council and can tell you a little bit of the from the streets sort of perspective of running.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me. Second of all, I think you all should give yourselves a round of applause because you're a beautiful audience. So you guys should give it up for yourselves because it's a beautiful sunny day in Wichita, Kansas, and we're here talking about democracy and politics. And that's what makes the engine go. As noted before, I am Lamont Anderson. I am the campaign manager for the Brandon Johnson campaign, candidate for District 1. How I'm here, as I imagine how most of you find yourselves here, or will find yourselves here, I'm just a concerned citizen. It's one of those things is that they say that you can't complain if you're not willing to engage the system. You can't change anything if you're not willing to go out and make that change. We always talk about change. We always talk about wanting to see change. So how I got involved in politics and elections and in the legislative process itself, I made a decision one day that I wanted to become the change that I wanted to see in the world. So being able to align with individuals who believed in fairness and equality and social justice and all of those things that we should all be treated and have the equal access to opportunities is what has led me here. And so from a campaign perspective, I'm not a career politician. I'm not a career politician, political manager, strategist. I am a citizen with a love and a passion for my community, for my future, for my kids' future. And a lot of times we talk about, you know, we want to get out in the communities and make a difference and we want to make a change and we'll march and we'll protest. But a lot of the times we don't understand that a lot of the changes that we want to see happen in our communities starts with legislation. And as long as we aren't engaged and in those rooms, crafting and helping and molding that legislation, a lot of the injustices and a lot of the things that we as citizens, that we as taxpayers, will continue to undergo those type of circumstances. So the greatest way to ensure that our society and our community, and looking from a scope of humanitarianism, that we can go forward and build for the present and build for the future, is that we have to be mindful, engaged, committed citizens willing to engage the system. President Kennedy said, as I paraphrase, the educated citizen has a duty and an obligation to be a precinct worker, whether it's a president, whether he or she is a campaign worker, or he or she is a candidate. The educated citizen has the responsibility to rise up and raise up and to create and form a society that is functioning, that can not only function, but be fair to everyone. So I'm here today as I'm working with a very good friend of mine who is in District 1, someone who I believe in, and we share those same ideals. We are individuals that we believe that in order to successfully see that change, then we have to become it. So we're out knocking doors, we're canvassing. It's a lot of work. Being a campaign manager, I will tell you this, it's like having a second job. It is a second job, and it's a second full-time job because there's always something to do. Whether it's Saturday or Sunday, there are no days off. You know, you wake up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, you have an idea, there's something to do. Your phone rings continuously. There's always something to do, so it is a lot of work. I will say also being involved at the campaign level, you get to work with a lot of exceptionally talented, beautiful people. The team that we currently have on the Johnson campaign team, I tell you that they are a remarkable group of individuals. Now, I will sit here and tell you that the life of a campaign manager is not easy. But I also will tell you that when you have fabulous, awesome people working with you, that job isn't so hard. And what makes those people on the Johnson campaign so awesome is because they aren't in it for the basics of politics. They aren't in it for the basics of a career. Each and every one of those individuals that I work with, they all believe in making sustainable change for the betterment of our community. And that's what makes everything so beautiful. So thank you.
Our last panelist this evening is Casey Yingling, who is filling in for another panelist that we had planned. So Casey, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm glad I get to fill in here. My name is Casey Yingling, and I currently serve as the Secretary of the Kansas Democratic Party, but I also am a partner in a legal and political affairs firm here based in Wichita. And we work statewide recruiting candidates, teaching candidates how to talk to voters and really get the message of the kind of race they want to run out to the voters. And I think what perspective I bring, and I think why I was elected to the board of the Kansas Democratic Party, is I am the only millennial voice on that board. And I think that we know in a totally nonpartisan way that there are three groups of people that are not engaged in our democracy right now. Those are millennials, which are the ages 18 to 35, people of color, and single mothers. And we can see in different races that we run for the Kansas Democratic Party and for clients that I have, that when these folks are engaged in the democracy and they turn out and vote, different people get elected. And to follow on what Neil was talking about, it's important what candidates are elected to office. But in a representative democracy, and why I work in politics, is the people that we elect represent our voice. They are there for the voters. And if we don't like the voice that is there representing us, it is our job as a voter to become engaged at some level, whether it's casting a ballot or working for a candidate, to ensure that the people that we're sending to represent us in this democracy actually represent our values. And so I think that I can probably answer some questions for you about how the rules work of running for office, maybe some finance things. But I think more importantly, if the thing that we hear all the time from people is they don't want to run for office because they don't want their dirty laundry aired to everyone, and who wants to do that job? And that's the reason that our democracy is in the state it's in, because what kind of people run for office are people that want to play in those dirty politics. And so I think that everyone is here because they're a great American and they care about democracy. And so if you care about democracy, you're the kind of person that should run for office. And the more people like you that run for office, That's how we change our system and make it the kind of system that we want to have.
Thank you. So let's kick off the discussion here. And of course, if you'd like to respond to any of these questions, you're certainly welcome to, and feel free to discuss back and forth. I'd like to just ask, first of all, I know that there are some people here who do plan on running for office at some point, but what can average citizens who don't ever plan on running, what can they take away from this discussion that we're about to have?
I'll take that one. Even if your name isn't going to be on the ballot, do what Lamont's doing. Find a friend. Every one of you knows somebody that is charismatic, that when they walk into a room, they are the person that gets everybody's attention, that can really explain things to people in a way that they understand and can get people behind them. And as an average citizen, maybe you know you're not that person, but you know somebody who is, and you should encourage that person to run for office. Or if you see a candidate that you're inspired by, whether it's on TV or in the newspaper, contact that candidate because they're waiting to hear from you. They want you to come and support them and give your ideas. We're looking for that all the time. So even if you're not the person on the ballot, there is something that you can do. And all you have to do is reach out. They're waiting for your call.
I'm going to just get my plug in here. You should be an election worker. You should work the polls. And I don't say that. I'm not being flippant. I mean that sincerely. The best election workers that we have are people who are engaged and who care about the process. You can work on a campaign and still work the polls as long as you can leave that out 250 foot away from the entrance of the polling place and not discuss it and not pull anything in the polling site. If you pull it in the polling site, you will be getting a visit from me on election day, and hopefully not the police with me. But if we do not have sufficient people running the polling places, people who care, people who are engaged, I will be the first to admit we do not pay our election workers well. What I try to offset that with when I'm making my bid to the poor person sitting next to me in line at the DMV or the tag office or wherever I am, and I see somebody who looks competent and can use technology and I'm recruiting them to be an election worker, is, we only pay you $7.50 an hour, but that's your tax dollars, so you shouldn't want us to pay you too much because then your taxes will go up. It's a hard sell. I try, though. But when we have the best way for us to make sure that our process is running correctly is to have that balance at those polling places. And we do everything we can to have a party balance at our polling sites. It is difficult in Sedgwick County because we only have about 23% registered Democrats in Sedgwick County, but we work very hard to have a party balance at our polling sites. That is absolutely necessary, and we do the same thing in our office. My chief deputy is the opposite political party as me, and I appoint her, and that is a very deliberate decision on my part to have a voice from the opposite side to keep me balanced. It also is very deliberate to try and show the public that we are doing everything we can in a nonpartisan manner. But we need that at the polls as well. We have to have that at the polling places. And one of the things I like to do is when people call me and they had a bad experience at the polling place, which happens, and I'm very sorry to any of you who have had that happen, next time you can make sure it doesn't happen if you work the polls and make sure it's done right. So that's my little plug.
Go ahead.
And one note on how important well-run elections are is that it helps us get past a really nasty, difficult fight, especially when it's close. And so I lived through that a little bit when I was in Minnesota at my first job during the 2008 senatorial election that, Al Franken beat Norm Coleman, the Republican, by 300 and something votes out of like 2 million total. And while the recount took forever, partly to figure out whether Lizard People was an actual write-in candidate or not, and other crazy things. But it was extremely non-controversial because Minnesota has a long tradition of civic engagement. They have very good election technology. They stick with the Scantron machines that work better. And so they went through the giant recount, and pretty much everyone was satisfied with the result. And Al Franken has been a senator since then, and he's won re-election, but not but and it didn't have this kind of thing hanging around his neck of thinking that he got there by cheating or his side cheated for him. And with all the problems we have in American politics with polarized voting and polarized electorate, it gets much worse if we're not confident that when we go and cast our vote, it's counted.
And to that, I would say there's one more thing you can do is that we are working to get post-election audit legislation passed. We've been trying for a couple of years. It keeps stalling out. So call your legislators, your senators, and your state representatives and tell them that's important to you. I think there's the will to do it. It's just how should we do it? And there's some bickering back and forth on how it should be done. At this point, I just want it done because I will tell you every single voting machine that we use in Sedgwick County and every single election we test. And by test, I mean we spend weeks and we run every single ballot that we could, every single ballot that's going to be run through that machine on at a polling place is run through that and tested. We test it and we have an algorithm so that we know what our results should be. We vote ballots on the touch screens and print them out and run them through the tabulators. You know, we switched this year. This was the first year we switched to a paper ballot system to where even when you use the touch screen, you have a physical paper ballot so that if we have a recount, we can recount off of that paper ballot. There's no ambiguity. There's no question in the law. That is a ballot that can be recounted. And then we can audit from those. So we are working very hard to get to a process that everyone can trust. But I need the tools to give you that trust. And that final tool that I need right now is post-election audits. So please support us in trying to get that passed. I would also just say, speaking to whether or not you should get engaged in just even the voting side, is that in the 2014 election, we had to literally, the County Board of Canvassers had to literally draw names out of hats, determine the winners of multiple races because it was an even tie. And most of those were small races, like township officers or precinct committee people. But when I hear people say something like, well, my vote's not going to matter, well, that's not true. It does. And you can ask several people who are on improvement district boards or township boards who literally the chairman of the county commission board reached into a hat and pulled their name out, and that was how the election was determined.
We have the first questions from the audience coming in here, and I'll read one of them now. An audience member wants to know, what are precincts, and how does someone become a precinct committee man or committee woman, and what is that role? Neil, maybe you can kick this off?
Well, the short definition is that you have to have subdivisions to run an election. And the smallest subdivision we have is precincts. In most states, a given precinct will, anyone who lives in that precinct will be in the same elected election districts from local office all the way up to anything that has a line drawn, so like U.S. House. Although, I say there have been some states in recent years, because of the sophistication of redistricting software, that have started to actually cut precincts. North Carolina did that a few years ago, and then they actually left some voters out that way and had to redo it again because they'd forgot. But North Carolina is a place of extreme politics in lots of ways these days. But and the precinct committee people are quite important because they are for the political parties, the people that basically are making decisions. And we can see how important precinct committee people are in the fact that those were the people, or I say technically the convention delegates for the 4th District, that got to determine who our two candidates were because of the oddities of the special election system. And so I had a student who was on the Republican side, and I joked that she was now one of the 126 super citizens. And if you want to be that, then the way to do that is to be a precinct committee person. And frankly, a lot of times, those are jobs that go either open or are there because of the person who is the least able to fend off the begging of party officials. But that's where real power often is within the party structures.
I think Neil did a great job explaining that. I would add that state law does not allow certain districts to cross precinct boundary lines, but school districts can cross precinct boundary lines. So like, say, there are some precincts that may be in multiple school districts, but anything pretty much city on above cannot cross a precinct boundary line. So like my precinct is a couple city blocks. That's because I'm sandwiched in, and if I can't be part of another precinct because it's in different districts. So we have a large disparity in the sizes of precincts in Sedgwick County, mostly due to district boundary lines. But the way we try to explain it to the public is that what you get to vote on is determined by your physical address. And so we have to be able to drill down to the smallest common denominator between you and your neighbor to determine which ballot you're supposed to get. And so those precincts are those boundary lines, but in city school elections, we'll even have precinct splits that we use to create ballot styles for in this school district and out that school district, in this improvement district, out that, yeah, you get the picture. So, but if we don't go down to that micro level there on each individual address, then we can't actually determine what candidates should be on your ballot. And ironically, we actually have a house in Derby that if you're in the living room, you're in one Senate district, and if you're in the back of the house, you're in another Senate district. That was fun to figure out what district they were in. So,
What are some of the offices that someone might run for that maybe people don't know about or think about, things that maybe make a pretty big difference in our daily lives but aren't, you know, running for mayor or city council?
Well, this is one that still is high profile in a lot of ways, but school board is tremendously important. And so, and not just if you have children, like I have two children in the Wichita Independent School District, who gets elected to the school board is a tremendously important thing, determining all kinds of things. Even, you know, not just what your taxes are, but how they're spent, and often the character of communities is determined by the decisions of a school board. And I know, for example, that Central and Webb, and driving through there is a catastrophe at 440 because of the decisions of the Wichita School District to eliminate busing for my son's school. I'm sure the Quiznos is really happy about that. But also, even if it's on a small school board place, I mean, these decisions matter a lot. And particularly if you're in a smaller area, the decision to build a new school, that can determine housing values, and can determine in a lot of ways what kind of neighbors you're going to have, or frankly, whether you're going to want to live there in 10 years or 5 years, depending on your particular procreation schedule.
Sorry, that one cracked me up. I would also mention township improvement districts, even down, again, we've already talked about precinct committee. I think the argument for precinct committee has very strongly been made in the last few years in Kansas, where you see state representatives leave office for a variety of reasons, and then you have precinct committee people of their party selecting the replacement. And we just had that happen in a district here in Sedgwick County recently. So that matters, but your township officers are determining, they're setting taxes, and they're taxing you if you don't live in a city and you live out in a township, and they're maintaining your roads and making determinations, and those are very thankless positions. You get paid absolutely nothing, kind of like school board, but you get yelled at by everybody who's mad about everything, probably, as most public servants tend to. But those are positions that are very important, and a lot of times, you know, we have we see a lot of offices that in the city schools that we don't even have candidates for. We're going to have multiple offices in the November 7th general election that there will be no candidate name, and it will just be a write-in line, and whoever gets the most write-in lines wins, whether you wanted it or not. Congratulations. We will send you a notice if you won the election. You can then refuse the position, just letting you know if that's what you want to do. But anecdotally, my brother used to live out in a little dinky town, I can't remember the name of it now, in Kansas, and he got elected to mayor and didn't know it until he got called and given the congratulations. He's like, so it happens. All of those positions are very important, but one of the things I think people also don't tend to realize is a lot of times if somebody has aspirations at higher office, it's more of a new thing that you see somebody jumping in who hasn't ever been involved in politics before. Most of the time they start building their name at those lower level offices and stepping up. So even if you think that township office or that city council office or that school district office is not that important, it is. And it matters, and you voting on that matters.
Thank you. Lamont, maybe you want to kick off this next question. Has our American focus on individualism irreparably damaged our sense of community, bond, and support? You don't have to kick this one off. No, I thought you'd have an opinion on this one.
Here's the thing. I think that we're in a day and age where community and family isn't pushed so much anymore. I believe that individualism is highly celebrated, more so than what it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. We have lost a sense of traditional values within our communities, within our families, within our country. I don't believe in participation trophies, certainly. It's all about a level of competition. But there's a way to be competitive and still to have honor and respect for your fellow man, brother, and sister while you're going through those competitive natures. And I think that a lot of times, that, especially when we look at the world of politics, we see a lot of the song and dance on CNN and those types of things that, you know, I have to destroy this person. I have to annihilate this person. I think Casey talked about it when we, you know, a lot of individual folks don't want to, everyday folks don't want to run for office because they're afraid of the dirty laundry coming out in the air. I understand that this is about winning elections, but I don't think that when you're talking about winning an election, it shouldn't be about a winner takes all. It should be about who's the best person to go into that office to push forward our community. So in a sense, I would say yes. And so in a sense, I believe the remedy to that is that we have to go back to the basics of being respectful and honorable and remembering why that we're in a lot of these things. It isn't to run for city council, to look to be the mayor, to look to be the senator. It should be to look to be the city council person, to do what's best for the people in your district, to work with the other city council people to build the best community and the best environment that you possibly can.
I think when you talk about what our society thinks, you have to think about that. Because part of what society makes us think, it's the effect of it. So when everybody tells everybody all the time, everybody's very focused on the individual and nobody cares about other people and the millennials are on their cell phones and they're lazy and they don't want to be engaged in politics, you're missing the bigger picture and you're a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you are working in politics and you go and you talk to regular folks that are not interested in politics, and maybe this is a Kansas thing, we care about our families, we care about our communities, and we have a lot of common interests. And they have nothing to do with what political party that you affiliate with. And I think that's the very key thing about running for office, no matter what party you run for, you need to go and, just like Lamont said, you need to go and serve those people that you represent, starting at the precinct committee people level. Your job is to communicate information from your party to the voters in your precinct. You're their first level of contact. And then those precinct committee people are under different districts, and all of those precinct committee people should work with those elected officials to make sure that what you're doing in office is representing the voters that elected you. And we know our voter turnout is low, so you are going to represent people that didn't vote for you and didn't turn out to vote for you. And as an elected official, you have to represent those people just as well. And I think that's what we're missing, is people go and they serve for office to serve themselves. And again, this is a representative democracy. You are there to serve other people. And if you see someone in office that's not serving you, take them out.
Thank you. I want to follow up on the notion of dirty laundry being aired, because we've mentioned that a couple of times so far. One thing that I'd like to know is, in your opinion, what are good reasons for people to not run, one? And then two, what do you do if you really do want to run, but you really are worried about the dirty laundry airing?
One, I think everybody's a human, and I think everybody that's a voter is a human. And so I don't know anybody that's perfect. And I think that people value honesty more than anything. And so the worst thing you can possibly do is have something in your past that you don't tell anything about to anybody, because somebody's going to find it out, and then you shocked everybody in the world with it. The best thing to do is be honest. It's in your life and in a campaign. So if you have something that happened, clearly if you're in the place that you want to run for office now, it's in your past. Everybody has a past. Be genuine and authentic and accept it and move forward. I think that the issue becomes not as much what happens in people's past that's truthful. I think what happens that people don't want to be associated with is they have a viewpoint, either politically or they have something that happened personally that is then exploited and blown up into something that is not and is not true and dishonest. And then that person has been broadcasted with a false light in front of their family and their friends and their community, and frankly, the community that they were putting their name out there to serve. And so I think that, you know, just like having trust in our election system, and we have a great election commissioner here that does a great job, we are very, very, very lucky. And so win or lose, we want to trust our elections, and we should not say, unless we have proof that there's something wrong ever with our elections. But two, think about what people say. Don't let these ads that come out at the last minute blur your better judgment. If something sounds crazy, it's crazy. That's it. It's crazy. Don't believe it. Move on. Because we're electing people to office based on emotional reactions to things that then the next day we wake up and say, oops, that was a mistake. Okay, we'll try again in 4 years. And we have to stop that.
And also, I mean, you know, one of the things about the modern media environment is that in some ways it's made everyone who puts themselves forward in public life vulnerable to the kind of things that used to only attack people who ran for really high prominent things. But one thing you can take from from the work of candidates that are advised by competent professionals and follow that advice is that if things are true about you in the past, particularly if you've involved yourself in the legal system, then if you get to a point whenever you might win, these things will be used against you in a way that you don't have control over. So, for example, if you happen to be in a strip club in the past, as part of your job that you maybe didn't want to be there, and something happened because of the actions of someone else, then if you talk about this kind of thing in February, then you can control that narrative. Now, is it going to be bad? Yeah, it is. Are you going to have to talk about it with your parents? You might want to, that you never had before, but that's the price of the game. But when you don't talk about this and it comes out on the schedule of your opponent, well, then you got a whole bunch of direct mail stuff going into people's mailboxes with saying X's version of Kansas with a kid looking at, you know, nude. We might say, that's horrible that this is the politics of personal destruction. Well, first, there are public policy issues involving strip clubs and all those kind of things that are relevant. And also, it's a window into how this person manages a difficult environment. And while campaigns are crazy, and really suck the life out of the people running and the people helping them to run, but also they're dry runs for how this person is going to behave in office. I don't know a lot about the new congressman from Montana, but I'm guessing he's probably not going to be the best at handling a difficult media environment because he just attacks somebody. And so that's information to help us make a decision. We often don't have a lot of information. But you should just assume now if you run for office, somebody's going to know about anything, because it's not that hard to figure out anything horrible about people. But in reality, most of us assume that people are just as lousy as we are and will then get past it. But also, in the last 2 weeks in an election, you have control over nothing.
I just want to say real quick on that with the dirty laundry thing. If you're inspired and you have it in your heart to do that, I believe if you have God honoring the truth, then nothing can hurt you. That there are things that will come out that you will have to manage those things. But if your heart is in the right place, you know, everyone has a past. So if you're inspired to run and you're inspired to make a change and make a difference in the world, don't let that. If that's no longer who the person that you were, we all make mistakes and we all fall short. So if you have God honoring the truth, do what you do, because we've all fallen short. And I'm more inept to vote for someone who I can relate to. You know, if you've overcome struggles, then that tells me that's a lot about your character, that you can get us through the bad times. You're not just someone that's there for the good times, that you can see the good and the bad, and that's the type of representation and leader that I want. Somebody who can admit who they were, know where they are, and have a future with where they're going.
And I think there's a distinct advantage as well with everybody gets really upset about Donald Trump's use of earned media. And I think that there are definitely pros and cons to his use of social media, but at the end of the day, he drives his own story, good or bad. And so exactly what he was saying, Lamont was saying, you want to control what people are saying about you. Don't be scared, because the people who aren't voting for anybody and aren't turning out to vote, it's because they're sick of fake people. And so if you're not fake and you're not following all the rules, that's attractive to people that are sick of politics as usual. So if you have a good heart and you go out and say it like it is, people will be attracted to that, that are not attracted to politics as usual. And I think that's what this group is really most about, is not just how do I get involved with the same people that are in politics right now? It's how do I get involved in something that I'm kind of disengaged with? And that's what it is be the person you are, because everybody's looking for that. Everybody's sick of the cookie cutter model of what's supposed to be in politics.
Thank you. I have another audience question here. Can or should the government do more to publicize upcoming elections, and what can citizens do to keep abreast of all upcoming elections?
I think that one's pointed at me, y'all. For most elections, ironically not city elections, but we do for school elections, we publicize the elections in a... There are very specific statutes that govern when and how we publicize elections, and even in what newspaper we publicize elections. We do our best within the confines of our budget to publicize elections. We have already conducted 4 elections this year, and we have another 3 still to go. We actually have one on July 11th. If you live in Minnehaha Township, you will be receiving a ballot in your mail. If you live in Minnehaha Township and you're registered to vote, you will get a ballot in the mail. But that is something that has been tossed around and asked. You know, in November of even-numbered year general elections, our office takes a very aggressive approach to informing voters, and we send out a flyer to every active registered voter that tells you your voting options, whether you vote early or by mail. This year, we even added in a way for you to find your polling location, trying to give that information out. That costs the county about $130,000 every time we send that out. So it is a balancing act. My entire budget for paying election workers for this year is less than $130,000, which I blew more than that for the April 11th election, just so you know. That is a question that I think, unless the state passes something that requires it, we're not gonna get county support to pay for, quite frankly. I'm not opposed to it, but I have to have the money to do it.
And I think that's a bigger point of, do we want to have campaigns be privately funded or publicly funded? Because when campaigns are privately funded by campaign donors, it's in your interest to only turn out the voters you want to vote in the election, no matter which candidate you are. And so I think if we want to have the public interest and more voter turnout and Tabitha to be able to do the job that she wants to do and the budget to do it, we have to change our thinking about how are we investing in our public infrastructure, and do we want to put more money into our elections? Do we want to have confidence under our elections? Do we want to have audits? Do we want to talk about fake security and things that are supposedly making our elections more secure when we don't have audits and we can't even talk about audits? And so we just have to start thinking about our priorities differently. Nobody wants to pay taxes, but we want the tax dollars we spend to be spent on things that matter to us. And so that's where you come in. Whether you run for office or you support a candidate, shift those priorities, those spending priorities. Learn about these micro things that actually are affecting our democracy, like the election commissioner not being able to hire enough workers so we don't have long lines, so people don't get sick of waiting and leave.
I'll just talk loud, apparently. I will say that sometimes it's not even not having the funding to hire people. It's not being able to find the people to hire. We frequently, I think every election since I've been election commissioner, which has been 5 years now, we always have open positions on election day because people cancel last second. You would not believe, I mean, even the April 11th election, I think we had 60 people cancel in the two to three days leading up to the election. And if it's one at a polling site, that's not a big deal. But when you have two or three, and if those two or three were your party balance, it's really bad. So one of the things that we've seen over the years is a reduction in commitment. And I think that's probably across the board, no matter what industry you're in, but we see people who will commit to working the polls. We will bring them in, we will train them. And then sometimes they just don't show up and don't tell us they're not even gonna be there. So sometimes it's not an issue of not having the funds, it's not being able to find the people to do it. And we hit social media hard. We are out there, as I've talked about here, as I talk about everywhere I go, and my children and husband are sick and tired of going places and me recruiting. Oh, that would be a great polling place. Pull over. My husband's, no, we are on a date. We are not pulling over and recruiting a polling location. I was even spotting them. I just got back from vacation, and we were driving past. I'm like, that would be a great polling location. The kids are like, we're in Mississippi. I'm like, what can I say? So maybe their office needs to know. That would make a great polling location. What's the county clerk? But that's where we need people like you to be involved and to step up and to be engaged. I know it's a long day. We are working with the county to get more flexibility, to have more open positions within our payroll structure, to be able to have people work half days so you can work half of that day. One of the things that we did this year was we rolled out electronic poll books, which has just been absolutely phenomenal for multiple reasons. But one of the things I love with it is I can now track the data. I can track real-time data. When I can pull reports after the election and see how many people were showing up at any specific polling location. And I have actually been surprised. I had areas that I had targeted and thought, these are areas where we're going to have lines. And the behavior of voters and when they show up actually is not universal across Sedgwick County. We have some polling places that they show up at 6 a.m. and some of them they show up at 10 a.m. and they have a line at 10 a.m. And so us knowing that, then we can start strategically hiring and actually sending people out for part of the day when we know, when we can look at those trends after several elections and say, this is when it gets busy. We can send a team out there at that busiest time and clear that line and then move them to another polling location that's busy across town. And having that information is going to be just an absolute game changer for our office because, you know, before we're looking at a piece of paper and we have no idea when you signed that book or we just have no clue. And so, and I am not normally available to come out to polling places and look at polling places on election day. I loved that on April 11th. I was able to go around and actually visit the polling places and see what was going on. But I normally am too busy to do that. So having information, but definitely getting the people, the right people to work the polls is a really, really big component of making a successful election.
Thank you. I want to talk a little bit more about strategy and back it up a little bit. And Neil, maybe you can kick this off here for us. But say you decide you're going to run for some position. Where do you start? And then if you all can elaborate on how to kind of build your team.
Well, it's one crucial question there is whether you're talking about a partisan office or not. So we get to vote on a lot of stuff where there's party on the ballot. We get to vote for some stuff when there's not. Although in things like, for example, the mayor, people are members of political parties who run, or at least the ones that win. But that's often the first place to start. And I know that even though party actually seems to be driving more vote choice in America in recent years, people like parties less. And actually, the research seems to say it's because people dislike the other party a lot more, which helps to explain partly the results of last November in that if you're primarily voting because you dislike the other party, the identity of your own party's presidential candidate might not be nearly as important as you might think. But political parties are here for a reason. They're made up of people that probably care about running for office more than you do. They're made up of people who might have actually done this for a living, and also who know who to talk to, could probably know which ones your neighbors are willing to give you money, even though you might not ever think this person would give you money. But also, I mean, parties are partly the answer to the previous question, which is how do people know that there are elections? How do people know the stakes? Well, political parties. And you can tell my soapbox. I mean, I think there's two kinds of offices. Ones that are partisan, and if you think that you're uncomfortable with partisanship for something, then maybe we shouldn't be voting for that kind of thing. Judges, for example. If you're not comfortable with it being a Republican or a Democrat, then maybe we should not be voting for that person. Some states, even you're not even allowed to say what party you're part of if you run for judicial office. But the political parties are a good place to start, and even if it's running for a nonpartisan office, because political parties love to look at those nonpartisan offices and find the person who's going to be the next state legislator. So that's a good place to start.
Do you want to talk about building your team, Lamont?
Given that I'm in a race, so I'm gonna keep this very concise and very secretive, kind of like my Bill Belichick. I can't give away too much for my candidate. I would say definitely if you're building a team, that's it. You want to find a great group of volunteers. Volunteers are the engines that drive a great percentage and portion of your campaign, and volunteers that believe in you, because the work is hard. Most of the time, the pay is nothing. So you definitely want to build a team that will be willing to go to bat for you and do whatever is necessary up under the legalities of every situation, but just more so willing to have sleepless nights and have long days and have 10 to 12 hour days and not complain about it. They're not complaining because they believe in you, they believe in the message that you have, and they believe in what you represent.
Give a little more nuts and bolts, I think, of what parts you need for a campaign. And I think it depends on how big of an office you're running for. I think all four of these things you need no matter what office you're running for. It just depends how you staff that, depending on how big of the office it is. So there's communications, what you're going to say to people, the schedule you're going to say it on, what events you're going to go to, fundraising, how much money do you need to make, in what amount of time in order to get your communications plan out the door. 3, field. Whose house are you going to go talk to? Who are you going to go tell your message? Who do you need to turn out to vote? Who do you need to convince maybe to vote for you and not the other guy? And 4, political. What are you going to do to make your brand stand out and make people like you? I think that's probably the best way to do it. So, if you're on a big statewide campaign or a congressional campaign, you're probably going to have one person that's in charge of each of those departments who then has a deputy under them that helps them execute all of that. Because the thing about those big races that I think nobody really realizes, they're businesses. And you are selling a product. And that product is really everybody's heart and soul for that entire campaign. And we call it campaign time. And campaign time is 24/7, 365, and it never stops, and you don't know what day of the week it is, and it doesn't really matter because it's what day you're doing this on the communications calendar and what day field is doing this, and that's how your time works. And I think that's a really important thing to realize about people that are running for office and the teams that work for them. They really care about this, and I think that we like to just say politics is dirty and who would want to be involved in that. And I think you can kind of see the difference with Lamont and my answers. It's optimism in this system. It's patriotism. I mean, the first race I ran for was student council in first grade. And ever since then, like, I just like to hear what people have to say and go make sure that people are doing what they should do. And I think that whatever you do and however you get involved, you want to focus on those things, but really, it's, at the end of the day, it's just talking to people, telling them your story. Fortunately, you have to raise some money, but if you go out and talk to people, you don't have to raise as much money, so it's a trade-off.
Now, is a treasurer a required member of the team? What are the requirements?
So
is that
part of the fundraising team? Mm-hmm. So when you file for office just with Tabitha or at the Secretary of State's office, you don't necessarily have to name a treasurer, but you have to name one within 10 days. Is that right? The Governmental Ethics Commission is who does your finance compliance for a state race or anything down. And then the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, is who does your finance compliance if you run for Congress. And if you run for Congress, please hire a compliance firm. hire a compliance firm. It's very complicated. You should not run for Congress on your own or you will have problems with the IRS. So maybe the state, and that's another thing, state, go to your party. You're going to have people that are going to be able to help you with compliance. Don't mess with any of that stuff. Follow the rules, and there will be people that can help you follow the rules.
Thank you.
I would mention that on the treasurer, if you are running for a smaller office, you can actually be your own treasurer if you would like, but you do have to appoint somebody. If you are running for a local office, meaning if you're not in 259 or City of Wichita, if you're in a second, third class city or any of the smaller school districts in Sedgwick County, all of those financial documents come to us. There's really not anybody assigned to monitor all those documents and campaign finance reports. So if you're a candidate, monitor your opponents because nobody else kind of is. If we know there's a violation, we'll call the DA's office and turn it in. But otherwise, there's not really, you know, like the governmental ethics monitors state and larger, you know, like county offices. But on those lower offices, there just isn't that at this point in Kansas.
Thank you. I have a question from the audience here. What are the typical budgets in hours and dollars for various offices that we've spoken about, from school board up to senator? How do those range out?
Well, one thing is you shouldn't be intimidated by what you read about, the kind of top line stuff that gets a lot of press. So, for example, in the north suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, now there's a special election for Congress, and that is the most expensive congressional race in the history of America. There has been so much money raised and spent that one of the Atlanta TV stations put an extra local news slot on at 5 o'clock and stopped running the Andy Griffith Show, just so they could actually take in the money for the ads. That is a highly unusual kind of thing. Just like, for example, the Kansas 4th election on April 11th was highly unusual. I did a little national media that for 2 days. That shows you how unusual it is. But that's not really how a lot of elections function. But also there is a minimum amount, because if a campaign doesn't raise a certain amount of money, particularly when you're talking about state legislature or higher, then it's like it doesn't exist. Because voters are, a lot of your potential electorate doesn't even know who you are, might not know what district they're in until they show up, especially if it's a nonpartisan election, they might not have any kind of cues. And so you have to have a minimum amount of money in order to go forward. But also you should be prepared that if you get elected to Congress, for example, something like a third of their time is just call time, sitting in what would look like a cubicle farm. And so, and the candidates that, and the raise more money tend to be the ones that win.
I think that that's true. And I think that we're seeing a movement now, and I hope that it continues, that people are now a currency that's going to matter in these campaigns for viability as much as money. I think that we've seen, especially here in the special election in April and some of these other special elections, if you can motivate a base of people, I think Bernie Sanders is another great example, and you can show that it's not necessarily dollars, but you have people behind you, that is sending a different message to folks. And actually, as somebody that comes up with campaign strategy, it's quite a bit of the time of what's more important. Do we get the dollars in the door first, or do we make sure that people know who our candidate is and have a real relationship with them before they go out and start running for office, where then nobody takes them seriously and they don't think they're credible anymore because all they're in it is for their ego at that point. And I think that the thing that younger voters and these disenfranchised voters are attracted to are people that are out and working in the community and doing good things for other people and not just themselves and not just to move themselves forward. And so I think if a candidate can go and show, hey, I have connections with this board and I do community service with this group and I'm, you know, serve my church in this way, and you have 50 different pockets of people together that support you, that number on your finance reports become a little less important because you have this great volunteer crew that you don't have to pay to go out and put your yard signs out. You just are paying for the yard signs themselves. You're not having to pay robocalls to go out. You have real people that will volunteer their time to work for you. And frankly, people like that a lot better. So I think that it's really important for people that want to get in politics in a new way. We need money, but people are just as important as the dollars. So do your call time, but do political call time. Call people and get connected and hear what they care about and what they have to say, because it's just as important as the dollars.
How do you go about raising those dollars as a candidate? This is another audience question. What are some strategies for raising money?
I would say, you know, your supporters, your friends, your family, always hit them up first. Definitely, you can have events, fundraising opportunities, little creative ways to get out in front of donors to show them why they should contribute to your campaign. There's all types of little creative strategies that you could do to get out there, but particularly some things that we utilize is, you know, is getting out, doing events, and getting our candidate out, and not necessarily asking for money or asking for donations per se, but letting our candidate speak so folks feel inclined to, and they want to support him, and they want to give him money. And of course, we do send emails and we do ask for money, so that's another part of it too. Sometimes you're just direct, you just ask. If you have a candidate and you're the best candidate for the race, and you want your community and your city to be behind you, then why not ask? The worst someone can say is no. So that would be my contribution.
Always ask, and always ask for a specific dollar amount. And that sounds crazy, but frankly, people are flattered that you think that they have money to give you sometimes. And so if you'll ask, I mean, don't be crazy, think about what they do. But sometimes even asking somebody for $25, you're getting them to invest in your campaign. They feel important to you then, and they know that they've bought in, and then they're on your email list and they hear everything about you, and then they might give you $25 later. So don't feel like you have to go and only find these super rich people that are gonna max out to you. It's not about that. We call it Rolodexing. Go through your cell phone and think about what they do for a living and say, okay, that's my $5 person, that's my $100 person, that's my Aunt Becky, she gives me a $15 check every Christmas, I'll ask her for $15. So, I mean, it's really how it starts. And for these small offices, you don't need that much money. But if you can't ask people to give you money for an office, you don't really believe that you can win, and you really don't believe you should be there, because all you're asking them to do is put skin in the game that they believe in you.
I want to kind of get back to the money again here and ask for more of a ballpark amount. Like, if you're running for a small office, what are we talking about? $1,000, $10,000? What are we looking at?
I think it's hard for us to answer that question because it depends on your district. I think, and it depends who you are running in that district and what kind of real change you have to make. I think, you know, you mentioned the Ossoff race in Georgia. It's a lot of money because you're trying to swing people to vote a way that they otherwise wouldn't. Now, if you're just focused on people voting the same way that they always do, you can probably do it under $500. But if you're in there trying to run against an incumbent, you're going to need to match them at the level that they're looking at. So I guess to answer your question, if you're looking at a seat, pull up the campaign finance reports for the incumbent and see how much money did they spend. Who were their donors? What kind of support do they have? And then look at your own Rolodex and think, okay, can I compete with that? Do I have ways or resources to match that or go above it? Or at least, okay, I see they did mail and TV, so I know I'm going to have mail and TV. You see they don't do that stuff. It might be a little easier. And I think the other thing about having volunteer resources, take an inventory of the talent of your friends and family, because I think that there's a lot of things folks can do that, even if you have political consultants, can help those political consultants do their job more efficiently and, you know, really know you and know your story and can get that across.
That's a great tip.
Yeah. And also that if you're running against an incumbent, you shouldn't be overly intimidated because they've raised a large amount of money in the past. Political science research on this subject tends to show that the most important factor in terms of fundraising as to who wins and who loses is actually challenger spending, which is more important than incumbent spending, partly because the challenger spending is needed to build up the kind of resources that the incumbent already has, name recognition being most important. And also, there's lots of candidates who raised and spent tons and tons of money, often their own money, because of the Supreme Court in the 70s. We all have a free speech right to spend all of our money on ourselves to speak, although I tend to think that, for example, the guy who was my governor in Minnesota for a while, Mark Dayton, because he's part of the Target fortune, has a little more money to speak with than I have in my wallet. And I kind of wish it was different, but that's not the country I live in. But often the people that spend the most money are not great candidates because they can hire people and they can get ads, but then just people don't like what they're selling. But what's most important is not so much, can I match the incumbent, but can I get to the point where a voter will know who I am, have an idea why I am preferable to the incumbent, and so you can at least get into that conversation.
Thank you. And a good segue here into the next audience question. How does a candidate get good face and name recognition? Maybe some strategies for that.
I can speak on behalf of my candidate. His resume and his track record speaks for himself before he ever ran into office. His involvement in the community was spectacular, very immaculate. So if you're thinking about running for office, you should certainly think about where you are and how you want to get there. And in the case of my candidate, Mr. Brandon Johnson, a lot of his work was at the state level with juvenile justice. It was at the community level, building relationships with actual folks in the neighborhoods, in the communities that were struggling and going through plight and just looking for opportunities. So from the scope of humanitarianism, where your heart is, that's the greatest way. If you're already helping and you're already engaged, you're already building up that capital within your community and within your city. And if your community and your city see that you are involved and pushing them forward way prior before you ever run for office, then you already have that build up by the time you launch for office.
And I think that was Brandon Johnson's a great example of that kind of candidate that understands the value of people as well as dollars, because and it's quantitative that he really did work, that he has name recognition when people say his name, and it's not name recognition he's built with money to run for office. It's name recognition because he's served his community. And so I think if you want to run for office, I think the first step is to become involved in your community, to be that resource to people that they come to if they know they have a problem, they know they can come to you and get advice. And so really, the best thing you can do is get in the community, join groups. If you don't want to join boards and you don't want to go to meetings, you don't want to be in politics. So you better practice now going to meetings. And if it's not for you, volunteer for a campaign or be an election worker, because I will back up Tabitha. The elections run so much smoother when we have good election workers.
Thank you. Another audience question here. Why do you think negative ads are effective?
Well, one thing is that negative ads might not be as effective as you think, partly because sometimes candidates will go negative because they don't have anything else available to them. Particularly candidates that have very, very high negatives themselves, the only real way for them to win is to drag their opponent down. But also, research tends to show that contrast ads tend to be effective, so you can actually show that your opponent is different than you. And frankly, like, we'll see it in the state legislative elections next year, there'll be tons of things that looks like negative ads, but in reality, their ads are saying, my opponent voted for a tax increase, or my opponent would not support funding for schools. My opponent supported Governor Brownback. My opponent was opposed to Governor Brownback. And those are real things. You might say they're negative, but they tell the voters what about given candidates. And also, when you consider that voters are not going to spend hours and hours and hours researching things, it's an information shortcut that is reasonable. Now, it's the nasty stuff is the stuff that comes out the day before the election and isn't entirely true. But in general, the most successful negative ads are ones that actually make a as clear a criticism of someone's record and positions as you can in 30 seconds.
I don't find that negative ads are that effective to encourage anyone to vote. What negative ads do is encourage people not to turn out to vote. And so if your goal is to suppress the turnout, and if you're not a great candidate and you know as long as a bunch of new people don't turn out, you'll probably pull it out, you're going to run negative ad after negative ad to make these new people that are excited about democracy turned off and not want to vote. So I think that as engaged citizens and as candidates and as campaigns, it's really important for you to go out and make a reputation and a name for yourself that is hard to tear down, and to be very vocal and to stand for things that stand for everything that you stand for 100%. Because if you do that, then you will have people behind you that believe in you. Now, sometimes it's not enough, but I think that's, people like perseverance. And I think that just if somebody says something negative about you, you probably have a whole bunch of supporters that didn't like that and are now even more encouraged to go and work for you again. So don't let negative ads discourage you. Actually, they should encourage your patriotism to turn more people out to vote so they don't work anymore.
Here's another audience question, and maybe Tabitha, if you want to kick this one off here. How can Kansas have a recount when state statute prohibits the viewing of ballots after an election?
State statute does not prohibit the ballots being recounted. It prohibits the ballots being audited. It depends upon, and there's some ambiguity in the laws regarding electronically cast ballots, which is why we went away from direct recording devices and went with a equipment that prints a ballot, so we physically have a paper ballot to count. That is the, you know, the, there's a lot of blurring of the lines in the definition between recount, audit, and even a contest of an election. There are records that would be available in a contest of an election that are not available in a recount. The definitions of recounts are pretty brief, and are, the purpose of a recount is to recount the votes as they were counted to make sure they were counted accurately. It's not to count them a different way. It's not to count them, you know, so for like for us with an electronic voting machine, we did not count them from a paper audit trail. We counted them from the electronic cartridge inside the machine, which is what we're supposed to use then to recount them. So it's, there's different things for different definitions, and it gets a little fuzzy, but that's why I am pushing for post-election audits, is so that we can, if we have a requirement that we're required every single election to audit a sampling of the election, then we get to the point where every single election, we're doing that double check, and we're making sure that those machines function correctly, and that, you know, our new equipment has a lot more security features than the old stuff did, and that's much easier for us to do a chain of custody than what we had before. So we're excited about that, but definitely having that paper audit trail, certainly with our new equipment, with actually having a ballot versus an audit trail, we will absolutely be able to count from that physical paper ballot in a recount. It's just, people need to be aware that if you request a recount, you actually have to pay for it, and only specific people can request a recount.
And also, this makes it even more important for us to value nonpartisan professional election administration. Because what Tabitha just talked about, if you plug this into a system like I study some Texas politics in the 40s through the 60s, you know, those, you know, there are ways of using facially neutral and nonpartisan means for partisan ends. And a post-election audit, I mean, you can imagine what, for example, a post-election audit of a Russian election would look like. And so, And you know, that most states, or maybe half now, have elected top election officials in states. Most places, it's the Secretary of State. That's one of these things we're kind of stuck with in America. But the idea of electing someone who's then going to run the election is the equivalent of, I used to ref basketball, of asking the team that won the last game to pick the official. And that's just a way to give you the same results over and over even if the voters don't want that.
I would agree I should not be elected. I will agree that the system can be manipulated if you are a dishonest person, but I believe that that is the reason that we need to have the balance of power that, like, I've worked hard to have in our office, where we have both political parties in the management, not just not somebody answering the phone that's a different political party from me, somebody who is directly involved in every single decision that is made in that office, to have that balance of power. But I would plug several things. One is, our voting systems are not in any way, shape, or form. There's no component of our voting system. It's not allowed by Kansas regulation for any component of our voting system to be connected to the internet, whether it's a voting machine or the computers that tabulate the votes or the computers on which we do ballot layout. It is illegal for those to be attached to the internet. In fact, our room where we tabulate the votes, we physically have no internet connectivity to that room, and it's a secured access room. Every keystroke that we do on those computers is logged, and there's no way those computers are hardened, and there is no way for us to interfere with those logs. You log in, everything you do, whether it's looking at a report or it's just opening a piece of software, is logged. We cannot have, due to federal regulations, we cannot have Microsoft Word, Excel, Access. None of those things can even be installed on these PCs. They are locked down. Our memory devices and our voting machines are military encrypted memory devices. We are doing our best to meet the challenges that are coming up. I will be honest with you, the challenges that are hitting election officials right now are fast and they're furious. We're seeing, you know, we're finding out months after the presidential election that there were election officials targeted with phishing emails. We did not know that. We were not told that information. That is a, that's wrong. Election officials should have been told that they were being targeted. I probably just stepped on a lot of toes, but we are right now, I was on vacation when that hit the news, and I about passed out in the middle of the ocean, which would not have been a good thing, because I was sitting on the beach reading the news story on my cell phone, and I immediately emailed our IT department, and I said, I know the county trains our people and we go through IT security, but I need more than that, and I want every staff member going more through that. So we are right now working with the county IT department to come up with a more comprehensive training program for our staff, and they're going to have to go through that every year and redo it every year. How do we make sure that the email that's coming to us contains a proof of citizenship document and not something with malware in it? Those are all things that we've got to find a way to respond to. But if we don't know where those attacks are coming from, how do we respond to them? So one of the things that has definitely shifted in the last, certainly in the last 5 years that I've been election commissioner, is it used to be my role was administrative. And I am now not only administrative, I'm unfortunately stuck in the middle of politics, which I suppose I should have expected, but I did not. But now I'm required to be an IT specialist. And that's new. That's new in the last several years. And so Sedgwick County has been just absolutely amazing, coming alongside and saying, absolutely, we will give you every resource we've got. They're doing research to help us set best practices for policies and security procedures to have in place. But we have to be more proactive, and election administrators across the country have to be more proactive than we have ever been. And we have to have resources to do that. We can't do that in a vacuum. And if I don't have money, I can't be going out and sending my employees to classes unless I pay for it out of my own pocket. And I'll quite honestly, if that's what it takes, we're going to get it done. But this is important. Our democracy and how our elections run are too important for us to skimp on it. Last year, the county manager kind of changed how the budgeting went. And they had a tiered process, a tiered system where you had tier one, and that was people who absolutely had to be funded. Tier two were kind of support, and they had to be funded, but at a different level. And tier three was kind of the good things, but we'll fund this as we can. And in tier one was like sheriff and EMS and the election office. Sedgwick County heard that we've got to make this a priority, and they are. But it's going to be a continual thing because the county has limited resources. So any of you, IT specialists, feel free to shoot me an email. If you're willing to come give us some instruction, I am willing to listen. So please feel free to jump in there, but definitely making sure that our system is secure. You should understand that is an incredibly high priority to me and to my staff. But it is something that we have to know what the enemy looks like before we can respond. So we are doing everything we can to think of everything that could possibly come down the road. I'm going to a federal conference in August where this is going to be a large subject that will be discussed ad nauseum, I am sure. But we will bring all of those things that we've learned back and implement them here. But certainly, if you have any expertise, reach out to me. I'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you.
And I'll just make one point, and I said this earlier, we are very, very lucky to have Tabitha as our election commissioner in Sedgwick County. But as you can hear from the explanation she went through at first about all the different rules about how we can look at our ballots and get recounts and get any kind of transparency about our election system to run election protection, that doesn't have anything to do with Tabitha. We have higher up powers that don't want audits of our elections. And so we have a great election commissioner that needs our support to get that done. I've made calls for that since 2012, and it doesn't get done. And so we are so, so lucky to have somebody serving our office that wants that. And I think that's just another point of why you want great people to represent you, because it makes a huge difference for what you get.
I have another audience question here. Approximately how many precinct committee positions remain unfilled, if you know, as a number or as a percentage?
It's on the Sedgwick County election website, isn't it?
Who's in those positions is on there, but not necessarily the list of which positions aren't filled.
You update them pretty often.
Well, anytime like a party gives me an appointment, we list that on there. But so we'll say who the current precinct committee people are, but it doesn't say this precinct doesn't have one. You see what I'm saying? So part of the question was who they are and which positions are open.
You don't have all the precincts listed up there?
We do on demographic reports, but it's not just a really easy, like we have reports that'll show you every single precinct, but that's not like sitting on the website saying, here's this position that's filled and this one's not and this one's filled. You have to do some work to get it together.
Well, your page is better this year than it used to be. I was going to give you props, but I guess we can improve it a little more then.
You know why it's a little better is because I got more staff and we have time to do it.
Thank you so much.
We don't know, but it's a few.
Well, I could run that. If somebody wants to shoot me an email, my email is tabitha.layman@sedgwickcounty.org, and I can find those numbers for you pretty easily. I just don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay. I've had people ask if you guys would consider putting the blank ones up there. I've had a lot of people ask me where I can get that, so if that thing would be good.
I'll see if we can put the answer to that question on our website somewhere. We'll see if we can put that on engageict.org. Another audience question here. I've got a bunch. I'm trying to get through them all. What do you think about alternative election formats such as ranked choice voting and the potential of changing election formats in Kansas?
Well, one thing to think about that is not terribly likely, because the people who win in a given system tend to not like changing that particular system. And also, on the state level, making changes to the state constitution is pretty difficult here, particularly if it goes against the interest or values of the legislature. So I was interviewed by Weedworthy magazine a couple of years ago. I didn't know that existed. I'm pretty sure I'm not. And I didn't put that one in my tenure file. Because KMUW interviewed me about the decriminalization referendum. I didn't want someone in the committee thinking I'm the weed political scientist. But the person asked me, what's the chance of there being marijuana legalization in Kansas? And I said, not very much. And he said, well, is that because Kansas is so conservative? Actually, primarily, no. It's because to change the state constitution or to do any kind of legislation in effect by state-right referendum, you have to run it through the state legislature. And our state legislature is made up of people that are not as interested in that as a population. So if, for example, we could vote on medical marijuana, it would pass easily. If we could vote on recreational marijuana, it'd probably be pretty close, and it might even pass. Certainly, it would pass here in Wichita. But we don't get to decide that because changing our general structure of government here in Kansas on the state level is pretty hard because the legislature has to let us do it. So we get to vote on whether we have the right to hunt, fish, and trap. Can't forget the trap. But we don't get to vote on all kinds of other things we'd be interested in, like, for example, ranked choice voting. Or my favorite one that not many people know about if you don't live in New York is let multiple parties run the same candidate. So New York has the Conservative Party that holds the Republicans accountable when they try to appoint people that are too moderate. They have a Working Families Party that has actually kind of made itself into the turnout arm of the Democratic Party backed by labor unions. That allows voters more say in things. And if you're running for office and you win, you could say, oh, I'm a Democrat, but most of my voters are on the working families line. I need to pay attention to them. But that's also not very likely either.
I would mention that when we purchased our new voting equipment, we made sure that it could handle any form of voting that we could find anywhere in the U.S. to make sure that if something changed, we could roll with it. I will say, you'll find this interesting, that the current chair of House Legislative Elections, Keith Esau, is actually talking about the possibility of ranked choice and doing some research into that. My understanding was he was going to have some people actually researching that option over the summer and looking into it. I have no idea if it will go anywhere. I know that, I cannot remember what state it is off the top of my head. Maine, yeah, I think so, that passed it. And then it's been challenged in court and has been, so it's going to be very interesting from an administrative standpoint. I've had people ask me my opinion on that. I view my role as, my job is to implement the laws and to do it. And if the legislature says we're going to do this, I may pitch and scream a little bit at home, but I'm going to do it. We'll find a way to do it. I don't know enough about ranked choice voting to actually have an opinion one way or the other because it's not something I've had to research yet. But just so you are aware, we have made sure that the $6 million of your tax dollars we just spent on new voting equipment can handle that if we want to change.
And I think that just comes back to the point of why are we here today and we keep saying the legislature is not going to let us do this and the legislature is not going to let us do that because only boring people run for the legislature right now. And so if you want some of these things to change, run for the legislature because they're not that exciting of people that are up there right now and they're doing a really bad job. So you could probably run for office.
So I want to get back to the how to run and kind of the factors that one must consider there. But as far as your family and your spouse, are there, you know, what do the candidate's spouse and family kind of sign on for when you're running for office?
If you work with our group, it's very, very important to me that the family is signed on. I think there's no way for you to run for office and get the support of other people in your community if you can't even get support at home. And you see that a lot. And it, you know, you don't have to be the best cheerleader spouse or necessarily be at every event, but you need to believe in the dream as well. And you need to support the dream. And at whatever level that is, you know, I think that's up to each family, but it's a lot of commitment of time with other people that aren't your family. And, you know, sometimes they become your family and sometimes you end up really not liking each other by election day, but you're with each other all the time. And so it's just knowing that you're going to open up your life and your home to a bunch of new people that are going to tell you what to do for the next 6 or 7 months.
I certainly second that. With my friend, Mr. Brandon Johnson, I've gotten very close. I knew his family. We were very close prior to, but since we've been running, we spent a lot of time together. A lot of texts, a lot of phone calls, a lot of 3 a.m. phone calls. I know sometimes his wife doesn't appreciate that. You know, she'll tell him to shut his phone off because I have a propensity to call a lot. But the thing about it is that when you're a candidate, your family then becomes a part of that election team. As Casey said, there is a time commitment. There is a great sacrifice on time. There's a lot of things that Mr. Johnson has to step away from to be out in the community and doing those particular types of things that maybe on those typical days you and I are home with our family. So there is a little bit of sacrifice to it, and so your family understanding and being supportive is huge because if you're out there doing those types of things and you're not getting that support at home, then it's going to weigh and strain on you. So I would certainly say that that's one of the things that is great about our opportunity is that with my guy, Mr. Johnson, his family is very understanding and supportive. So that certainly makes a run a very lot easier.
It makes a lot easier for a candidate if they have a power couple. And I mean, it's not required. And every power couple looks different, but when you have somebody that can be your number one surrogate, that can go and make calls for you and talk about how great of a job you're going to do, like, that matters to people. And so even if you don't want to run for office, if a spouse wants to run for office, it's a team thing. Like, you're both running for office, and it's, you do different roles and wear different hats, but there are two candidate clients I'm thinking of right now that their wives are the reason that they are in office, because they are fantastic ladies. And so I think that there's a lot of different roles you can play on a campaign, even if it's your family.
I would add to that, not necessarily from the campaign side, but even if you're not looking to be a candidate, but you're looking to be involved in the community. One of the things that I did not see coming was how many hours it was going to take to do my job. And part of that was because the office had been reduced from 2008, I think there were 9 to 11 full-time staff members, to 2012, there were 4 of us. And that is absolutely insufficient to conduct a presidential election. There's no way you can do that with the amount of registered voters we have. And that was very clear. We had issues, and I will own that. We have worked very hard. I have worked very hard to get us to the point that we now have 10 full-time staff members. We had a $1.5 million budget last year, as opposed to $670,000 in 2012, and 4 staff members. That has been a long fight and a hard fight, but it's been a fight that I had to make because we could not conduct proper elections without the resources to do it. But one of the things that I was not, and I don't think my family was prepared for, was the fact that even now, with having 10 full-time staff, when you get to June in a gubernatorial or presidential election year, June to December, if I work less than 80 hours in a week, if I get home before 10 o'clock at night, my children are asking me, what happened? Did you get fired today? I'm not kidding. They do. What happened, Mom? Why are you here? If I come home even now, and people keep saying, well, this is your off year. It's not our off year. We have 7 elections this year. We don't get an off year. Even now, if I come home before 7 or 8 o'clock at night, they don't. They look at me funny, and they don't know. And we came off of a presidential election year and immediately went into preparations for a special congressional. We had not even finished counting the write-ins from the presidential election. We had a whole board count and write-ins, and I'm like, our congressman's going to leave, and we've got another election. We haven't even certified this one. Are you kidding me? And we had to roll out new equipment. We thought we had till August. We had till April. You know, we had all of those things that had to be done. So we went from June really until end of April working absolutely insane hours, people not being allowed to take vacations. If you're sick, that's too bad. You have to be in the hospital being cut open or you're at work. Wow. And I am not kidding you. Primary election day in 2016, I was so ill. I was so ill. And I'm still standing there trying to look not dead on TV going, go vote. Excuse me, I gotta go, you know.
Thank you. And
you know, you have to be there. That is not just elected officials. It's people who are in public office. And missing 5 years of your children growing up is very difficult when you look and you come into office and your son's 11. And he's in college, and you miss things.
You have a time warp.
Mm-hmm, you do. And what I experienced was just that coming back afterwards to being part of the family.
So I have kind of a relating audience question, relating back to kind of different tactics as far as running for office. What advice do you all have for helping candidates speak cross-culturally and interracially?
I think what I always tell candidates is don't assume you know anything. You're not there to tell any other community anything other than your story. You're there to listen to what they have to say to you and then take what they have to say and use it and move forward. I think what people try to do in politics is go put on a show of what they think people want to see and what they think people want to hear. And really, people are people, and you should go have conversations with each group of people how you would any other group. And if you go put on a specific hat for a specific group, that group's going to know you put on a specific hat for them, and they're not going to trust you.
Thank you. I've had a couple of questions come through sort of relating to this, so I'm going to go ahead and ask this one, even though it doesn't relate specifically. I think it's a question of whether or not we trust the system. How do we make sure there is no voter suppression? So I guess if someone's going to go out and run for office, what, should they trust the system?
Absolutely, absolutely. Like, we cannot even pause on that. Like, if we don't believe in this system, what are we doing here? Why is anybody running? And I think that anybody that runs for office or works in politics has to do their absolute best to make sure that we all have trust in this system, because if we don't have trust in it, we have nothing. And so I think, I work with Tabitha quite a bit on election protection, and I think it's very important to both of us that everybody's vote counts and as many people get to vote as possible. And if there is suppression, we always, or any sort of image of suppression, we always work together to try to stop that, because unless everybody works together to have trust in our system, it's not going to work.
And that's exactly what I was going to speak to, is the reality is whether you're a candidate running for office, you're a voter voting, or you're someone working in my office, we're all working towards the same goal, or we should be, and that's to make sure that every person who is legally allowed to vote gets to vote. I work within the confines of the state laws. Everybody doesn't always agree with the state laws. I don't always agree with the state laws, but I work within those confines. Exactly what Casey said. If you have concerns, I'll go back to the April 11th election. We had a lot of rumors swirling around that we had moved polling locations in low demographic areas and that we'd done all of these things. And I had these people calling me, and I was so grateful that they called me directly to find out what happened, because we did not voluntarily actually move any polling locations. We moved them because we had to. And actually, none of them were in low demographic areas. And so when we have rumors just flying around about things, and I am so tunneled into making sure that all the ballots get out the mail and everything that comes back is counted and all of these things, that I'm not necessarily on social media seeing what's out there. I can't answer to what I don't know. And there's a lot of misinformation out there that flies around, and picking up the phone and calling, shooting me an email saying, hey, I heard this. Is this true? If it's true, I'm going to own it. If we screw up, I will own it. But I don't like being hung for stuff I didn't do. Really, so, don't.
Tabitha, there's a question from the audience that relates to this. Mm-hmm. They're saying that working as a polling agent, one of the problems that they observed was citizens getting to the right polling place, and that no one seemed to understand the maps or had the app. What can people do to really figure that out beforehand?
Well, we have, Sedgwick County has an app where you can go and type in your address and find out where your polling place is. Prior to elections, we also send something out. What we have happen a lot of times is we will have people who have moved and their notice bounces back and they don't receive that notice. If they no longer live at the right address, we can't get that notice to them, and there's some problems with that. But in fact, actually just this last legislative session, there was actually a law passed that says we are required to, within 30 days of an election, send notice if a polling place has changed. And we were supportive of that law. It was not a problem. But we have changed. We had some issues in 2014, and we were just sending little postcards that was your voter ID card, kind of saying, you know, just what your polling place was. And we changed that to where we actually now send a physical letter. It's got large red letters across the thing saying important notice, polling place change. Those are the things we're trying to do. But certainly, if you don't know, call our office. You can go online and check it. We have seen, unfortunately, that we have some well-meaning citizens or campaigns sometime. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus here, but that will send out information that is not necessarily correct. And so we get people sent to the wrong polling locations, and we don't even know where that information came from. So certainly contact us so we can get you to the right site.
And back on the question of voter suppression. As citizens, we have a responsibility to call BS on lots of things that people say, because when anybody who is in office is arguing for changing election rules because of high principles, we have to be careful that those principles are actually implicated and there's not something else there. So, for example, people talk about a lot now that there are so many million, the number changes a lot, fraudulent voter registration in this country. Well, if that's true, then I might actually have one or two of them, because I might still be registered to vote in St. Joseph, Minnesota. Now, I don't live there anymore. I don't fly up there to vote on election day in the morning and then go to Minneapolis and fly back here to vote again. That would be illegal, but I don't think anybody's really doing that. And also in this state, we have had lots of attention by our elected officials on the question of who gets to vote, and we've had a very, very small number of prosecutions that in general have been people who frankly often think they voted correctly because they happen to live in a couple of places. And apparently the cost for that is $5,500 now. But in reality, the question is, what is the problem we are willing to solve? And frankly, I would say the problem in America is it's hard to vote. My government should know who I am and where I live, and then I should be able to show up and vote. And you can do this. Minnesota does this. North Dakota doesn't even have on-site voter registration. They figured you'd know if they weren't from North Dakota. But in a democratic system where the people we elect then get to make the rules, then we have to be vigilant on that.
So I want to switch back to the process of running for office and get to kind of the topic of social media and text messages, because that's been seems to be a really growing area. What's behind that, and is that now a new requirement?
I'll take that one, because it's a new technique that we employed for James Thompson's congressional campaign, and I think that it was very, very successful. Why it was successful is it penetrated into a universe of people that don't respond to anything else. They do not respond to political mail. They don't respond to political phone calls. They do not answer their door. But they would text back. And it was shocking. Like, that's not what we expected at all. But you start looking at the demographics, and it's these same demographics I've talked about all night. Young people, people of color, and single women, busy people, people that are disengaged in the system. And so I think social media, text messaging, I think the best way to use those things are as a supplement to the old school ways of doing things. You want to put people in a group of what do they want, what do you need to talk to them about, and what is the best way to talk to them? What is the thing that they're going to want to hear from you? Are they somebody that don't want to talk to you, but they want to read a mail piece? Okay, then they get the mail. If it's somebody that's going to talk on the phone, we do that. And with these younger generations and people that are very mobile, texting is the way to get a hold of them. So I think that if your goal as a campaign is to turn out young people, you're going to utilize texting. If you don't want young people to vote, you are not going to utilize texting.
So we're running out of time here. I just want to ask you all one more question. What do people running for office tend to get wrong? What are some of the common mistakes? And then what advice would you give?
I think the biggest thing that I've seen is that when individuals, sometimes they run for office, they try to become something that they're not, to fit a particular mold. They lose who they are. They become concerned with winning the race as opposed to serving and honoring their constituents and pushing the community forward. I think sometimes when we lose sight of those types of things, you see a shift in a candidate. You see the value shift. You see the purpose behind why they even ran in the first place. You see that go away. So my biggest piece of advice on that aspect is, don't get into the realm of politics and running for office for a power or career move. Get into it because you want to make change and you want to become that change in the world that is fair for everyone, not for a particular group of people, but to create an environment to where all of us can be successful and have the opportunity to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and have equal equality and access to all of those characteristics.
And I think along with that, and the only way to be successful and run for office and have good motivations is to understand that it's work. You're not in this for everybody to wave at you and tell you how wonderful you are and, you know, be in parades and be in a pageant. Like, that's not what this is about. You're going to be on the phone asking people for money that don't want to give you money. You're going to be talking to voters who want to know why you support this, that, and the other thing. And you're going to be up at 5 a.m. and go to sleep at 1 and in the car with a staffer that wants you to make call time while you're driving in the car and you just want to take a nap. And that's your life. And so if you're really not in it for the right reasons, you're going to be a not very nice person when that is your life. And so I think that's what you see in candidates, that they don't really know what they're getting into. And then when they get into it, they freak out and don't want to be a part of it anymore. So I think really you want to evaluate your personal inventory, what's going on in your life, with your family, with your finances. Are you able to take on a new full-time job? And that's, you know, really what you're doing. Again, with that being said, don't be scared, because if it's something that you really care about, it doesn't feel like work. I mean, I think those of us that work in politics, everybody knows we're a little bit crazy compared to average folks, because this is what we do all day, every day. Like, who wants to get called at 3 a.m.? But it's because we really love this. And when we get an idea, we're excited and we want to talk about it and work it out and get it into motion. And so I think that energy is important, and you have to have that energy if you want to run.
Thank you. Any other thoughts on that subject? Neil?
I guess one thing that I think people who run for office often suffer from some of the same kind of blinders that people have when they're in office, which is to assume that if everyone else or a majority doesn't agree with you, then somehow that must be the system is rigged against you. And so we can see the effects of that in the problems with the town halls that for a lot of Republicans have these days. The assumption that somehow, that if people, even if you're that if you're elected in a district and then you're representing that district and then you have a town hall and then most of the people there tend to disagree with you, somehow they're outside agitators. I study the civil rights movement. It's just like the same arguments with different nouns from the 1960s. And it's fundamentally undemocratic to think that in your district there's no way that you could get 1,000 people in a high school gym that disagree with you. Whenever you consider in almost every U.S. House district, there's probably 50,000 people who voted for even the candidate that did the worst in a given area. And so, also if you're running for office and you strongly believe something, you might think, well, everyone agrees with me because whenever I talk about it at the bar or at the coffee house or at Thanksgiving, no one disagrees with me. Well, that might be because they don't really feel like disagreeing with you. And it's your job to present what you want to people so that they can make a choice. But just because you lose, or because you're losing, or because when you get elected it's harder to get reelected, it doesn't mean that somehow the system is rigged. It might just mean that your fellow citizens believe something different. Because frankly, democracy at its core is about losing. And it's about losing and staying in the game. Because also, whenever you see an election result like a lot of people do and say, oh, well, this isn't, you know, when something happens, like, oh, that's not America, or that's not Kansas, or that's not Wichita. Well, maybe it is right now. But you can change that. And when somebody says, this is America, and you disagree with that, then make them wrong. And the only way to make them wrong is get in the system and fight it out.
Thank you. Let's have a big round of applause for our panel. That was a great discussion. We had a lot of great questions. There were more questions. We just didn't have time to get through them all. Thank you all so much for coming. I really appreciate your time. And we will have a related topic next month on July 11th. Our Engage ICT Democracy on Tap subject then will be off your elections. And why bother? Well, if you don't know yet, come find out. And even if you do know, come and hear. We'll have another wonderful discussion. Thank you again for coming. I hope you have a wonderful evening, and good night. Thanks for joining us for Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. Find more podcasts and videos at engageict.org. This show was hosted at Roxy's Downtown in Wichita, Kansas. Our engineers are John Cyphers and Torin Anderson, and I'm the host. For KMUW, I'm Sarah Jane Crespo.